Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000. You'll notice that you can contribute to the Legal Defense Fund under a new address. The mail goes to the Michael Savage. That's if a check, a money order, cash. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor. San Francisco 94111, and God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech.
Savage.
Now, let me talk about my dog for a minute, because it's a very interesting thing. If you see the world through the eyes of a dog, you can see an awful lot of the world that you normally wouldn't see. Yesterday, I finished my radio show in San Francisco, and then I went for a walk downtown, in the downtown, as people were boarding buses and running to the underground and getting in cars to go home. At about 6:15, 6:30, I walked around the streets of downtown San Francisco for the first time with my little dog. Now, he's a small dog. He's a 9-pound toy poodle. And I noticed something peculiar. Not that he peed on over 50 to 100 items in that 30-minute walk. That unto itself is a biological phenomenon that I don't understand. I don't know if there's sufficient liquid in his body to have covered all of the garbage cans, telephone poles, bushes, etc., in that short radius, but somehow he manages to muster even more fluid just when you think it's impossible. It's like watching a high wire act that you say can't go further, and it goes further. So to make a long story short, I'm walking little Teddy around, and I'm watching the people go home. It's one of the things I enjoy doing. I like the hustle and bustle of a city. I go berserk if I stay in the suburbs too long. I go berserk, totally berserk. So I watch the people coming and going. I watch them going into the bars. I enjoy watching people relieving tension by having a few drinks after work in the upscale bars downtown. I like the boys and the girls talking, the men and the women, et cetera. The car's coming, the car's going. And I generally just enjoy being alive and feeling the fog on my face and hearing the hustle and bustle of a city at the end of a day's work. But I noticed something as I walked little Teddy around the streets of downtown San Francisco after the radio show last night, which is how few people even noticed there was a little dog in the street. How many of them were like robotic? Now, I got to tell you something. A little dog like this is not a common sight in San Francisco. In fact, what's amazing is how few dogs you ever see in the downtown area of San Francisco at all. There are dogs in San Francisco, but they're generally not in the work district. That's not 100% true in other cities. In some cities, you actually see animals downtown. But let's just put that aside for a minute. You don't see dogs there too often. You don't see a cute little dog like this. The point I'm getting at is that people are like automatons. They don't notice them. Now I'm going to ask you a question. What kind of person, race and ethnicity sex, do you think, A, noticed this dog more frequently than the general population, and B, of those who noticed the dog, who smiled the most? This is a small, unscientific sample of downtown San Francisco, from which we can generalize if we choose to, which we will. Because I find that generalizing from subjective observations is as valid as generalizing from objective observations. What did I just say? Anyway, the question is, who do you think smiled at the dog the most? And who do you think didn't even notice the dog the most? Racially, no. Which race? And B, why am I asking you this question? Answer, because I refuse to talk about Democrats and Republicans. Absolutely refuse, will not do it. Not my cup of tea. Now, if you're offended at me, I can understand it. And you can call me if you're offended. But I'm going to talk more about dogs and a movie I saw last night on The Savage Nation. Or if you're bored of those topics, I can talk about the care of old clocks, because I collect old clocks. And many of you don't understand how incredibly wonderful it is to have a pendulum clock that's over 100 years old that still runs properly. and to wind it once a week and to hear a tick and to make sure that it's running properly is an amazing relaxation for me. I know, don't get me wrong, it's not the cure for anything. It's just a hobby of mine. Sacramento, Tom, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, Dr. Savage, I definitely think that the Caucasian young females would like the dogs the most. No question about it. They still have
them. Well, that's very interesting. Yes, the dog is a chick magnate, That's funny. I'm sure he's a chick magnate for other small toy poodle girls, but he is a chick magnet, but that's not what I use him for because I'm not in that category of operations at this stage of my life. But they were not the number one group that smiled at Teddy as I walked him the street. It was young and middle-aged Asian men, mainly Chinese men. Would you believe it? You'd never, ever expect that because you would think Asian men are very taciturn and to themselves and don't show their emotion like everyone else, but perhaps even a little more so. But the dog melted a lot of the Asian guys, and I saw them smile, and I thought it was beautiful to see. That's something that you should know for a couple of reasons, which have no relevance whatsoever to the news. But what astounded me was how most people didn't even see a dog walking around amongst them. They were robotic. They didn't even notice them, you know. So now, before I'm going to take a few other calls on these wonderful topics in a minute, and then I'm going to talk about a wonderful film I saw late last night with its political implications to today's events. And the movie was called Shake Hands with the Devil, starring James Cagney, 1959, black and white, Turner Classic Movies, my favorite channel now. I just love that. I love the announcer. I love the elevated train. I love the whole thing about it. And then I settled back, and I know I'm going to get 2 hours of a movie, an hour and a half of a slower-paced movie from another time, shot in real film stock instead of video, so the depth is better. And it's particularly when you get a black-and-white movie, you're going to get not only depth, but you're going to get real color and great cinematography, as opposed to today's kind of overly processed Kodachrome, and I'm not knocking Kodachrome, Kodachrome-style colorization, which I don't like. If I wanted that, I would just look at the pictures of the Senate candidate from Florida, Kathleen Harris, if I wanted to see colors exemplified. And the reason I'm going to talk about James Cagney in this movie is I never thought he was such a great actor till I saw this. He plays a surgeon in Ireland in 1921, a teaching surgeon at a hospital, who by night is the leader of an underground movement for the Irish Republican Army. At that time, it wasn't called the IRA. It's quite gripping because the protagonist is not so much Cagney as it is an actor who plays an American medical student, a surgical student, who does not want to be involved in the fighting in Ireland because he had just come back from World War I and he said, I've seen enough killing in my lifetime. I'm a friend of yours, but I'm not going to kill anymore. That's how it starts. But eventually the American gets drawn into the battle, and it's against the black and tans, who are a particularly vicious group of thugs sent in by the British military to terrorize and brutalize the Irish into submission. Now, the story is not only a beautiful art, beautiful in terms of art and a great story, but it has phenomenal relevance with regard to Israel / the Palestinians, Iraq / the Americans, and other such topics today. And I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of that movie right here on The Savage Nation, the greatest talk fest in town.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Tampa, Florida. Ken, you're on The Savage Nation.
Hi, Mike. It's not a dog I'm talking about, but it's a 17-year-old cat, and golden cat, and it is an incredible story. I went on a trip to San Francisco. My brother lives in Reno, and we drove to San Francisco from there, And we had a hotel all set up, but we had no idea if we could get the cat in. So we figured, well, we better sneak the cat in. So we go through a whole incredible fiasco to get this cat in there. We get the cat in, and then we spend 3 days there, and we're leaving. And as you were talking about who was more impressed with your dog, and it was amazing. When we left, I was walking the cat. I held the cat, and I walked right to the restaurant. And everybody, all the Orientals, I was in Japanese town, was so incredible. They were all just smiling and laughing, and they kept saying, "Tiger, tiger, tiger." It was amazing.
And it's funny because normally they wouldn't respond. They're very quiet people. They're not, let's say, they're not outgoing. But yet the animal brought that out, right? That's what you're getting at? I know it's very amazing. People don't believe this story.
They don't talk to you. But when
Asian people love animals. That's the funny thing. Anyway, my friend, thank you. I want to move on to them because I don't understand how fast the show is going, but I know what's going on now. I'm back into my old format, which is forgetting politics and talking in general about more interesting things, and the time just flies. So I want to go to the movie. Listen to me. Shake Hands with the Devil, 1959, starring James Cagney. So the plot summary is as follows, and it's directly relevant to today's troubles in the Middle East. Believe me, it is. In 1921 Dublin, the IRA of the time battles the Black and Tans, and they were special British forces who used extremely brutal measures against the Irish. Then there's the Irish-American medical student, Kerry O'Shea, hopes to stay out of it, but while saving a wounded friend, he gets outlawed and then drawn into the rebel organization under his former professor, James Cagney, the professor. Complications arise in the plot, and I don't want to give it away, but he falls in love with a beautiful English hostage, and she's gorgeous. I don't know who this actress was. I think I have her name here. Jennifer Curtis. Never heard of her. Stunning. She could have been a big actress today. She had genuine beauty as opposed to the silicone frauds that are in Hollywood today. And doesn't look like a slut, mind you. We're not talking about cheap white trash, you know, who get away with it with a little silicone and slut-like behavior because of the vermin who run Hollywood. This was a classy lady. Here's the story and how it relates to the Middle East, in my opinion. You watch the movie. Now, of course, it was written to be sympathetic to the Irish. There's no question about it. And I'm sure that it was written with that intent. And it was written with that intent and played by Cagney, I'm sure, because he's Irish and wanted to show the side of the Irish, not the English. Now, without getting drawn into the whole English-Irish thing, please, let's not go there for the moment. I want to draw a parallel to what's going on in the world today. Towards the end of the movie, the general who was leading the IRA, who was not Cagney, is very happy because the British have agreed to a peace treaty. And the peace treaty will grant the Irish dominion, their own parliament, and whatnot. And then there's a showdown with Cagney, the surgeon, who says, I'm not signing it. He said, we agreed that we'd fight to the end to have total freedom. The general says, but this is better than killing and bloodshed, which will go on forever if we don't sign it. And Cagney says, the only reason they're offering you anything at all is because we've got him beat. I'm going to fight him to the end. So the general says, well, we're not going to fight him. He says, well, then there'll be a civil war between us and you. He said, but we fought shoulder to shoulder, he says to Cagney, for all these years. He said, well, that doesn't matter. I'll fight you to the end. Anyway, as the movie moves on, Cagney is shown to be a cold-blooded murderer, even though he's a surgeon and he's quite a sympathetic character through most of the movie. He is seen at the end for what he really has become, which is simply a bloodthirsty, psychopathic murderer. From all the years of violence, he has become an unredeemable man. Now, we come now to the politics of the day. The story now can be taken to the Palestinian/Israel situation. Here you've got the Palestine Authority, the PLA, who have brokered a deal with the Israelis, for better or for worse, for better or for worse. And they want to stop the violence. They're now facing the Hamas, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, so-called, and the others, and the Hezbollah, who say, we're never going to sign a peace treaty with the Jews. We're going to kill them all and get them out of here. We want all of the land. And the PLA says, but that's crazy. The bloodshed will never stop. So the Palestine Authority, whether you like them or you don't like them is irrelevant, want a homeland of their own Whether you think it's right or wrong doesn't matter. There are 3 million Palestinians, and they're going to have their homeland. It's just an imperative of time. It's just going to happen, period. You don't have to like it. You don't have to like it at all. Well, you can love it. It doesn't matter. They're going to have a homeland of their own. Now, then you've got elements within them who are so bloodthirsty, they've been steeped since childhood to hate and kill Jews, that they will never, ever sign a peace treaty. And just as in this movie, shake hands with the devil, just as Cagney is killed off in the end because he's a bloodthirsty devil, that's what has to happen in Israel. And it's going to happen from within within the Palestinian Authority itself. They have to kill off the psychopaths amongst themselves to bring peace to the area, relative peace, and to see a two-state solution to the area. And likewise in Iraq. The Iraqi government has to get strong enough to kill off the insane, bloodthirsty maniacs, allegedly now being run by Zarqawi. I don't believe a word of it. It's run by Iran, probably in Syria. God only knows who else, probably some Saudis as well, for all we know. All of it's done by money. But only when the Iraqi government can kill off the bloodthirsty amongst them will they have a nation again. I mean, the movie is amazing. Highly recommended. Shake Hands with the Devil, 1959, black and white. And one more note about it, which is the imagery. The directing was pretty good, but by today's standards, you know, when a guy gets shot and there's no blood and there's no bullet wound, it doesn't make sense. That kind of thing. But the imagery is fantastic. The cinematography is extraordinary. The beautiful B&W photography is great. The director's Michael Anderson, cinematographer Erwin Hillier. And here you have a director at work who understands what he's doing. He understands the purpose of the movie, and he has the creative capacity to pull off what he's trying to do. It's a very unusual movie for its time. And I believe, although I'm not an expert on it, Scorsese and Spielberg are saying that this director's work, Michael Anderson, is deserving of much greater recognition. So I highly recommend the movie, Shake Hands with the Devil, and it's based on a novel by the same name by Reardon Connor. Reardon Connor, if you're looking for a rental. I just love Turner Classic Movies. Love the guy's intros to them. So that's it. There's nothing more you could say.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
And now on to the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255. Debbie, KNEW San Francisco, go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. How do you do? Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Savage, I do suffer from psychological and psychiatric illness, and I denied it for many, many years, having heard stories of my grandmother in New York, who at a mummer's parade had just been released from a psychiatric hospital and was a little too happy, so was returned by black wagon to suffer another round of electroshock therapy. So growing up, when I myself found myself to suffer from similar symptomologies, refused to go get help. And I'll tell you, I do believe that humans, and I find it interesting that rather than recognizing that we do produce very...
All right, so but what is your main point? Of course there's mental illness. There's always been, marginally crazy people and overtly crazy people. We know that. So what is it that we're disagreeing on?
Well, I think it's not subjective, sir. I think that there is a scientific way of producing diagnoses by way of examining common symptomologies and behavior.
It's not that precise. That's the point, and that's where the rub lies. The doctors would have you believe that it's easy to diagnose and definitively diagnose that mental illness, and I disagree entirely. It's not that easy. Now, I've seen brain scan studies, don't get me wrong. I've seen the different colorations in schizophrenics and others, but we have no fundamental argument here. In other words, I know there are people who are unstable. I know there are people who are totally crazy, and I know people who are rock steady and never suffer any such orientation. So where the argument arises is, can we control some of these proclivities through means other than medication is the only argument that I think we're having.
Well, I definitely think it can be controlled through medication. The disappointment...
No, you didn't hear me. You see, you went right over what I said. I said, can some of these symptoms or conditions be controlled with means other than medication?
I think it depends to what extent an individual is suffering. In my case, the answer is no. I spent many, many years seeking out. I went to Marin County. I saw the best nutritional therapist, and I wish I could say their names on air.
Did you try mega doses? Well, I'm going to pick one thing out of the air. Did you try massive doses of niacin?
Sir, I tried niacin until my skin was so red, I look like...
I'm only asking because I want to know how far you went along with nutritional therapies. Of course, they're not going to work in all cases. But you did try Dr. Hoffer's niacin therapy.
I had more niacin in my blood. I went to Oregon. I went to L.A. I had neurosurgery for a very bizarre...
They looked at your iron levels. They looked at your folic acid levels, correct?
Everything. I had more blood panels drawn from me.
You went that route. The route didn't help you, and now you're on major antipsychiatric drugs, and you feel better, correct?
I absolutely feel better, and I've been on
Fine. Well, no one's arguing with that. But I'm saying don't put children on Ritalin the minute they show signs of being a boy.
I absolutely agree with that as well.
All right, so there's no argument. You'll get me crazy if I keep talking to you another three minutes. Three more minutes, I'll need to reach for a pill. 1-800-449-8255. You go crazy from it. I once went and visited a holy man, a religious teacher. He was a former pugilist, a boxer, who then went into religion and became a religious guy, but he still maintained the man of the street. He knew reality. In other words, he didn't come from like an effete background. I was suffering at the time through various things that were going on in my life, mainly societal social engineering that made me feel like a failure because I was not granted what I had earned because they wanted to put people with less qualifications and of other races and of other sexual orientations. Total morons, by the way, given jobs, which is why the university has fundamentally collapsed in America in many departments, certainly not in all. And I was feeling it. I had two young children. I didn't know what was wrong. I killed myself. I did great work. I published my dissertation at a Harvard University journal. I mean, it was pretty good stuff that I did. And they hired whack job moron feminist tree huggers or people from countries of origin other than the United States of America to make them feel good and to look good on the brochures. So I go to see this holy man, and he says to me, what is exactly your problem? And I explain it to him. And he says to me, you know, we have a saying which says that if you take a stick and you put it into a dog, he used the word, I can't say it, let's say dog waste, I'll put it that way on the show. And he says, no matter which way you turn the stick, it's still dog waste. And he said, now, if you don't mind, I have to excuse myself right now. I got very mad at him. I was fuming because I wanted some mystical experience in this holy man's office. He told me if you take a stick and you put it in, you know what, and no matter how you move the stick around, it's still you know what. What he was telling me is stop moving the stick around and you know what. And he was right. See, so there are many ways to cure problems. They're not all medicatable. Not everything needs medication. Sometimes common sense works. That's what I'm trying to tell you, is that there's an epidemic of loss of common sense. An epidemic of loss of common sense. We have a nation of ninnies. Everyone walks around, medication. I want my medication. I want my crutch. I want my drug. I want my medication. I want Uncle Sam to pay for my medication. I'm sickly. I want my drug. Well, maybe you need your drug and maybe you don't. Maybe you're just a weak individual who refuses to take control of your own life. You know, you have diabetes and you're still eating Krispy Kreme. I wouldn't give you medication. I'd make you pay for your medication if you refuse to modify your diet. And you want me to pay for your diabetic treatment, for your treatment for diabetes, and so forth and so on. If you're not willing to help yourself, why should I help you? That's why our taxes are out of control in this country. But more than that, psychiatry is often used as mind control, societal control in our country. And I want to make a very big political point now because we're moving very, very close to the ex-Soviet Union where psychiatrists were used to diagnose people who were antisocial or antipolitical. They were then taken away by the secret police, medicated into submission, and thrown into re-education camps. If you think we're not moving in that direction, my friend, you are mistaken. Some well-meaning psychiatrists are this far away from recommending that political dissidents in this country not be medicated. Trust me on this. I'm sure it's being discussed that anyone who suffers this phobia or that phobia can only be treated with major pharmaceuticals. And I can guarantee you, as I sit here, that it's going to come from the homosexual radical community, that Christians who believe in the word of God are psychiatrically impaired by definition, and they should be medicated, and they should be reeducated. That is the only way to cure them of their God, of their God madness. I can guarantee you it's being whispered in psychiatric halls. So don't tell me I don't see what's coming in this country unless you stand up to this juggernaut of the medico-legal profession, the medico-pharmaceutical legal profession, because they're all intimately involved. Now, that's not to throw away all of medicine. That would be foolish. And I've never said that. That would be a ridiculous thing to say. I'm talking about integrative medicine, where all of these modalities are work together. You don't jump to one or the other. That would be like saying, oh, let's never use drugs and let's only use dietetics. That's absurd in most cases. So don't think that I'm a zealot in one area. But I don't want to be led around by the nose and to believe that there are no effects upon mind and body other than those that can be cured by drugs. The drug establishment is out of control in its power over the mind of the people. Take a look at the Viagra ads. I turned on Fox, CNN, MSNBC. I flipped around at 15 minutes after the hour all day. All I saw was a white-haired man dancing a woman around on a floor with a big smile as they left to the hotel room and said, Viagra, Viagra, Viagra. Every channel at 15 after the hour. Every man needs Viagra over the age of 40, according to the advertisements. Could it be that the man is impotent? Excuse me, erectile dysfunctional because he really doesn't want to have sex because he's not in heat? We are the only animal on earth who is deluded by our societal images and pressures into thinking that we should be, wow, I'm raring to go 365 days a year. I can spring up like a 15-year-old. I'm a potent man. There's no animal on earth that is potent 365 days a year. We're the only animal who's been deluded into thinking we should be. So now we medicate the fact that we're not attracted to the woman. We're out of sync with the desire. Or we shouldn't be having sex at all right now. Why must a man have sex 365 days a year? Where have you read an animal that has sex 365 days a year? It's unheard of. So in a sense, we are a totally insane society being led around by our nose.
Savage.
U.S. couples seek separate bedrooms. Ah, look at this story. A survey by the National Association of Home Builders has predicted by 2015... 60% of custom-built homes will have two master-bedroom suites. This is an amazing story. The quest for better rest is behind the trend, as experts say the lack of decent sleep can cause marital tension. The option of having separate rooms has often improved marriages, they say. And they're not calling it separate bedrooms because people are embarrassed to admit it. They call it a flex suite to avoid any embarrassment. And it says the trend is not restricted to the upper end of the market. They say that with the practical necessity, snoring, nighttime visits to the bathroom, children, shift working, couples are often deprived a good night's sleep, so they're having two separate master suites. Let me tell you a little secret about that. It's only the poor who sleep in the same bed for their whole life, generally, and not everybody, don't get me wrong. It's a mark of poverty to have to share a bed with someone your whole life. The fact of the matter is, if you study the history of this, let's start with the royalty. They never shared the same bedroom. Never mind the same bed. We're not talking about in the beginning phases when they're in the 90 days of marital heat. That's an understood fact. The 90-day period is over after 90, 91 days, according to every study that's ever been done. 90 days of insanity. By 91 days already, it's over. It goes on to a certain extent. But after 90 days, you have to live with this person. So first, it starts out as twin beds in the same room, very close to each other with a little nightstand. Then it's not so much twin beds. You get the bigger beds in the same room. Then if you have a little money, it's two bedrooms. That's how it works. But that's the fact of the matter. There's no shame in it. You can still get together when you want. But you have two different lives, two different minds. Why do you have to share every second in the bedroom? What, that's some sacred place to be there? The way people are today individually, they don't want to be in the same room. And by the way, this is not limited to America. I spent many years, I'll give you an example, an anthropological experience about men and women. In Fiji, let's go back to the years I was going to Fiji in the village. and this is a delicate subject. The men had a men's house and the women had a women's house. And when the women went through their monthly cycle, the women went into the women's house with the other women. The men didn't want to be around them. Now, what does that make the men in Fiji? Does it make them sexist? Does it make them whatever ist you want to call it? They know from their culture that they didn't want to be around the woman at that time for whatever the reasons were. And I got news for you. The woman would rather be with her friends at that time than the guy. So he went over to his the friend's house. They all hung out and slept in the same big straw hut. And the women slept together. That's how they did it in Fiji. I'm giving you one example. So this whole idea of how to raise a child or how to live with a woman or a woman how to live with a man, there's no set rule. There's no set rules in this area. And a lot of what we see going on today is a devolution, not an evolution. The people don't even actually understand how to live with each other or how to raise children. And what they always do is try the liberal methodology in every case on the natch, and they think that by going on the natch with liberalism, it's going to work, and it often doesn't. What you have to do is go back to the traditional methods of raising children and the traditional methods of living in the same household, man and woman, woman and man.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I almost feel like now moving away completely from the politics of the day, which I've been talking about, and almost going into, I don't know what I did last night, the bars I drank in, the people I ran into. Let's see, what did I do last night? So as the curtain of night descended upon the Savage Nation's host, yours truly, Michael Savage, I wandered up to the district known as North Beach in San Francisco, the more or less still Italian district of the city. Actually, I didn't go directly there. I walked up California. I have a certain walk I like, which I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to be, let us say, accosted on the way. But I walked through Chinatown on the way to North Beach because I love Chinatown. The reason I love to walk down Grant Avenue at night is because it gives me hope to see the small merchants closing their stores at night, raising their gates, securing their wares. It reminds me of my father's little store down in New York on Ludlow Street, how they would close the gates at night and lock it up and look with a love at the merchandise that fed their family. Now, you don't see much of this anymore in America. Most of us are so removed from merchandise and being a shopkeeper. But in essence, the small businessman, the small businesswoman, is the core of the capitalist system and always has been and probably always will be, despite the dominance of the great corporations. The small businessman is the key to the survival of a capitalist nation. Anyway, to make a long story short, I also like to see the Chinese people. I like hearing, as I walk down the avenue, the young men, the vigorous young men practicing martial arts in the upstairs studios, either through the drums. The drums are also part of the martial arts. I hear them practicing Taekwondo in some of the studios. I mean, I hear everything. I'm like Vincent the Blind Man, if you want to know the truth, because as I walk, although my eyes are open, so are my ears, and I have very sharp ears, and I listen to the sounds of the street. I don't have to know one word of Mandarin to understand what's going on. And I say to myself, you know, this gives me hope. And the reason it gives me hope is because I know that the Islamo-fascists will never conquer the Chinese, not in China nor in America. I said, are you kidding me? You're telling me these Tongs are going to let the Islamo-fascists dominate their neighborhood? Never in a million years. They disappear without you even knowing what happened. And there are so many other ethnic enclaves in this country that will never fall under the sway of the sword. That's all I can tell you. They have faced the conqueror in the past, and they have driven the conqueror out. Of course, there are, if you want to get into the history of China and its conquest, and it was conquered by the Muslims at a certain point, but I won't go into that because you don't know that half of China is Muslim and a good half of China was Muslim as a result of conquest. But in the United States of America, I can tell you right now, they don't even know this is going on. These people live in their own world, and it's kind of nice to step into a world that is separated from my world. So I walked through Chinatown, as I said, smelling the garbage in the street, and walked across Broadway, where I you step across Broadway. Now you're suddenly stepping into the garlic world, the world of garlic and jazz, so to speak, and you're into the Italian district. And for some reason, I went to a place that I haven't been for years. I used to hang out there a lot. It's an Irish bar. And I looked for my friend because I hadn't seen him in years. I stopped hanging out up there a number of years ago. And I went into O'Reilly's Tavern, and there was Miles, an old friend of mine running an Irish tavern. And we talked. I said, how's your son? He's 10 years old. And I haven't seen him in 5 years or more. I remember when he was a little boy in the bar. And I said, you know, I still remember your English, your Irish, what was he, an Irish, what do they call those, giant dogs? Help me out. I forget it. And you know those big dogs, whatever they're called, the Irish something or other. No, not an Irish setter. They're gigantic. They're hounds. They're giant. He had a dog, Fionn. They only lived to six. I love this dog. I watched him grow up in the bar. This dog was so big that he, like a foot was as bigger than my dog Teddy's entire body. And one of the most beautiful dogs in the world. But he died at six. I said, you know, Miles, I remember your first dog, Fionn. He says, oh, I had a second. And he died too. He says, now I have a third, just a wee puppy. He's still got the Irish whatever. I'm sorry I don't remember the name of the dog. I'm feeling kind of silly right now. I can't. But, you know, it was nice going in there. But on the way in, two guys offered to buy me a drink, and I never accept a drink from a stranger. I'm just that kind of girl. So I didn't accept the drink from the strangers, but we got to talk. It turns out that they're sheriff's deputies from another county in California who just happened to hear my voice and say, I can't believe our luck, and we talked. And we talked about the fact that white men are being driven out of every sheriff's department, out of the highway patrol, and every police department in the state of California, being replaced by lesbians, being replaced by primarily Mexicans, being replaced by anyone but a white male.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000. You'll notice that you can contribute to the Legal Defense Fund under a new address. The mail goes to the Michael Savage, that's if a check, a money order, cash, Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. And God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech. You know how I love my dog Teddy, the 10-pound, 11-pound miniature poodle. He's like a piece of me, okay? I love the guy. Now, usually about 3 in the morning, he rustles around in the bed and he forces me to get up, which is convenient for a male, actually. I get up anyway, and he goes out in the garden, and I stand there freezing or whatever. Then I let him back in, and then he goes back to sleep until we get up in the morning. But lately, I'm like on strike. I don't want to get up at 3 in the morning and stand there and watch him take a dump in the garden. So what I did last night was he started, like, rustling around 3 a.m. I knew what it meant. But I'm not in a great mood lately, and I wasn't able to get up for a damn dog and to go watch him, you know, stand in the garden there freezing. So I said, leave me alone, Teddy. Just do what you have. Just leave me alone. So he settled down. I figured, all right, I get up in the morning. Everything's fine. And no sign of nothing, this and that. Then I put him in the garden. I see he's doing the circle thing and the squat that makes every dog look like freakish and ugly. And I turned away. I didn't want to see it. But I figured, all right, thank God he waited the night. But it was a slow day. Everything's starting slow. The coffee machine didn't work. That Italian machine, it makes noise and it comes up with, refer to manual and you call and talk to some kid in Newark with like a Rocky accent put in the filter. And I almost got scalded in my groin. I couldn't make coffee. I had to go back to the Sears $10 coffee machine. The white trash coffee cup worked fine. I go downstairs to my studio and boom, guess what Teddy had done? Crapped all over where I sit next to the microphone and the screens. He never did this. Of all the places in the house, look how smart they are and how they'll get even with you because I didn't take him out. He didn't go in a corner under a curtain. He didn't run to the back door and say, Dad, if you find this, it's because you were bad to me. He went downstairs in the dark of night, snuck into my studio where I broadcast from, or I'm sitting in front of the computer all day looking for idiotic stories to report on, and he all over the floor. And here are, he's here with me now in the radio studio. I didn't hit him. I didn't yell. I just left. That's all. I packed up and got out of the house. And here I am at another house. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this world? The dog is even, he's even breaking down from the stress of this world. Who can take this? OR, New York City. Anita, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Michael Savage. How are you? I loved hearing about Teddy.
Well, but it's terrible. I mean, you know, my life with Teddy, here it is. It's the ups and downs. It's like a child, you know. But who expected him to pull that stunt on me?
When you speak of him, it sounds like a little child. He does.
I don't know how to put it to you this way. When my children grew up and left, there was a vacuum in the house that's the only parents who've, you know, had a child and have raised the child. When the child leaves, there's a vacuum that enters your heart, your mind, and your soul that only a parent can appreciate. And that's the good news, meaning they go off to college or whatever. You know what I'm saying? God forbid you should lose a child. I can't imagine that hole. But the point I'm making is when you replace that loss or that emptiness with a dog, they really become like a child to you in a way, strangely enough. If you love animals, you don't have to become a sicko to take care of the child. He's in very many ways, he's like a two-year-old child.
Exactly. I love animals personally. Myself, I just love them.
Do you love them when they crap on the floor under your desk? I don't.
Well, you just have to clean it up. I mean, that's what
I didn't clean it up. I ran out of the house. I think it's still waiting for me when I come home tonight. I'll kill him when I get there. He's sitting here looking at him smiling. Makes believe he don't know from nothing. I didn't even hit him. What can you do after the fact? He knows what he did. He knows what he did. He did it because I wouldn't get up. So tonight I have a real dilemma. Now I won't even be able to fall asleep for fear that I'll fall asleep and I won't wake up. I don't know what he'll do next. No, I'm not going to let him train me. Never. I'll have to deal with this one in another way. I'd rather talk about poodle poop than Hillary Clinton. I would find it more interesting to analyze poodles and their poop habits than to talk about Democrats and Republicans, to be honest with you. That's how far it's fallen. I mean, I'm devolving. Maybe I'm devolving mentally from the stress of listening to this rubbish day in and day out. Joan, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. We love you. You're brilliant, and you're so right about everything.
That's a nice opening. Who can disagree with you?
I I just had to call you because I had a poodle. Beauregard, and he lived till 15, but
oh, thank God.
Time we went out, we came home, and there was the poodle poop all over the floor.
Ugh.
But I couldn't, it was just so funny because you...
But he doesn't do this to us. He doesn't do it to us. It was only last night he punished me.
Oh, okay. So, mine used to do it like he's getting back at us because...
Now we're going to get, it's already too scatological, but... All right, thank you. See, watch a show devolve before your eyes. Just watch a show go right down the tubes. I'm reaching a point where I don't know whether this is more interesting than listening to the wisdom of George Bush.
Savage.
A couple of years back, I had an air conditioning system put into my house by a legitimate air conditioning firm. But I didn't know who he was using for labor. Well, today I had an American air conditioning man go in, a guy I know, to look at adding something for me. He said, do you know that your panel is burned out from what this guy put in? You could have burnt your house down. That's what we're talking about here, Mark. I had no idea he used a substandard electrician. I thought he used a union electrician. I had no way of checking.
But that's what they're using. They're using nothing but illegals.
Right. He got some guy who learned it in a trade school in Guadalajara, if that, or picked it up along the way. He didn't tell me that. He used somebody, some illegal alien, probably relative, and passed on the money he saved into his own pocket. I didn't ask him to use a cheap electrician when he put the air conditioning in. So this is what we're talking about. Thanks. See, I'm a lucky guy because I come from a blue-collar background. Otherwise, I don't know what I'd be. It's very good to have your feet on the ground and know what reality is. And I don't know how a person who grew up in living off the fat of the land where everything is handed to them can know really what's going on down on the street level. I guess that's what I'm very lucky in a way that my father was so mean to me. To me, mean. I didn't want to do what he made me do. To me, it seemed mean. But he was right in a way. We fought like crazy. But I'll never forget to this day the day he dragged me out of that house and said, that's it. I'm never the fight. It's going to be in my book, by the way, my autobiography. The reason I'm living through all of this again is because I'm reviewing all the stories over the years that I've told, and I had them printed up, and I'm editing them. And I found the one where I was a kid sitting at home every night. I was talking about watching Walter Cronkite on the news at night. And I'm eating a steak, I'm eating French fries, and I'm eating cherry vanilla ice cream every night like a fat little porker. And my father comes in 6 o'clock gray from the day's struggle over the Queensboro, over the bridge and the tunnel. And God knows if business was no good, he's white from the day and from the commute. And here's his fat number one son sitting there with being fed like King Farouk, the steak, the fries, the cherry vanilla ice cream. In other words, a heart attack diet. And he turns gray as a ghost seeing that I'm – so he says to my mother one day, I must have been 12, that's it. You're ruining the kid. This is over. He's coming into the market with me every Saturday from now on. No, I don't care what you want. You're coming in. So I went from this spoiled little world down into a Dickensian basement in his store where I had to work like a Bowery bum cleaning the bronze statues with the cyanide solution. I've told the story before. I don't want to tell it again. It'll be in my autobiography. But the point I'm making is I resented it. But in a way, I mean, I learned an awful lot about hard labor, horrible labor, disgusting work, and I was able to do it. And to this day, I got to tell you something. Once you're trained to work, once you're committed to being a worker, you can't stop. There's no retirement. Because once you – what do I mean retirement? I don't even know what the word means. I'm an inner-city kid. I'm not proud of it. I'm not unproud of it. I never really learned to play tennis. I never learned to play golf. I know friends who grew up in the same milieu I did who early on took up tennis and golf, and I, that's what they want, fine. I never found it interesting. I found the games too slow. It's like watching paint dry to me to play tennis or golf. And I know it requires skill. Don't get me wrong. I'm not just blowing it off. It takes tremendous skill, but boring? I can't believe it. I'd rather roll on the rug and play with my dog and stick my fingers in his mouth and pull on his canine teeth than play golf. But if you like it, God bless you. And it's a tough game to do right. The point is a little different. When I went to college, skiing just became big in America. I remember, and some of the guys I grew up with took up skiing and they went to Mount Snow in Vermont. I got the ski pants, but I never took up skiing. I liked the outfit. I thought that they would attract girls, so I got ski pants. And they worked. I got to tell you the truth. In those days, it was before I could afford to eat a lot, so consequently, the ski pants had their benefits. But I never took up skiing. I learned how to use a sled, and it was fun to go down hills in the Bronx on a sled. I almost got killed under a truck. To this day, I can remember the truck. Remember the days? Could you imagine? I grew up in a time when trucks had chain drives on them. Monster trucks that had chain drives going around their wheels. So a kid's uncle, but we put three of us on a sled. The uncle must have been 20. To me, he was an old man. All three of us bellied up on a sled, American Flyer, I think, whatever. Who knows what it was. And was shooting down a hill, and he lost control of the sled. I swear to God, it went under the truck as it was moving. I thought we were going to be crushed and shot out on the other side of the truck. It shows you what kids go through. They can die by accident for no reason whatsoever. But I've worked minimum wage jobs. I worked in an ice cream factory. Horrible, disgusting summer job. Putting ice cream bars inside I'm on a line in a factory. You ever work in a factory? Well, don't talk about the minimum wage unless you have. You try putting 24 bars of frozen ice cream inside a box as it comes by you in about X number of seconds. And if you miss that box, the foreman, who was a little Italian guy up on a platform, was like out of slavery times. He screamed at everybody all day long. It reminded him of me today. He stood up there on the top, and he's watching the line go around. There must have been 200 people. Most of them were young Puerto Rican women and men, if I remember the factory correctly. And I had a summer job. I was glad to get it. My friend's father owned the ice cream factory. Didn't do me any good. They put me on the production line. So you had to fill the box. The boxes are coming around. I don't know how many seconds. You had to stuff them in 5 seconds, let's say. If you missed your 24 bars in that box, he stopped the line. He hit a button, the overseer. And he yelled out, "You moron idiot, you. Look what you made me do, you stupid moron." Oh, those were the days. I had a teacher, for example. I can't mention his name. He had two fingers on the right hand. How do you have two fingers? It was alleged he was in the IRA and he blew a hand off putting in a bomb somewhere. Now, he happened to be a wonderful math teacher. I don't know whether it was a bomb or whatever, or he was born that way. But this guy, Mr. W, was a tough guy of the old school type. And when the tests would come back, you sat there in fear. You shook. You sweat because you knew what was coming. He would read out your name and your grade. And believe me, if you were a dummy and you got a low grade, he'd make you come up to the blackboard for everyone to look at you like you were the big dummy you were, and you dreaded it. That's what made you study. You didn't want to be humiliated in front of the kids. Now, today, the opposite is true. Today, they take the moron and put the moron in front of the class and tell you that the moron is smarter than you are. And the smart kid has to hide his smartness because you're living in a communistic America. This is a communist system we haven't developed in this stupid country of ours. Don't play tag. You're liable to make children feel inferior. Don't do this. Don't do that. And that's why we're a nation of losers. I'll be right back.
Yeah.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Now we can move on. We don't have to stay with this. Let's see what I have for your entertainment. I don't know what else. I can tell you about my day if you like. You know, how about a personal story, human interest story now in the middle of all of this? It's quite interesting. It'll take me 1 minute or less because there's an interesting point, and it begins with a staple cut. I had to go to the laboratory this morning for a medical test, for blood test that I've been putting off for at least 4 weeks. Every day I stared at the form, you know, and I wouldn't go. Every day I stared at it and said, I got to go tomorrow and make sure when I get up, don't eat anything, don't take anything with the blood, the lipids and the schmipids. So I put it off every day, but I made up my mind today was going to be the day. I go down the driveway in the morning in the bathrobe to get the paper. I pick it up, take it out of its blue wrapper, and I try to rip something off from the paper, and I cut my finger on a staple which said, "Merry Christmas, my name is Jose. Can you please leave me a gift in this envelope?" So my finger bled. I said, "Oh, my God, what a bad start to the day this is going to be." You know, you give the newspaper guy some money. The guy comes in the middle of the night. Why not? You throw him a $20 bill, a $50. Who knows what we give him? I don't know. We put in the envelope. I never stiff anybody. I know what it's like to be almost a slave in this country. I go to the thing. I get the butterfly, the six vials of blood that come out of me. I never felt better. I'll tell you, there may be something to bloodletting that we have to look into. I have a doctor friend who's very healthy, who's an orthomolecular physician, who bleeds himself on a regular basis. And he swears it's a very healthful thing to do. So I said, "Well, what's your theory about bleeding yourself? Why is it a healthful thing to do?" And he said, "Well, for one, it removes the iron from a man's blood to a certain extent. As you well know, iron can be somewhat toxic with regard to coronary artery disease." And I said, "Well, what's the natural evidence that you have? He said, well, it's very simple, Michael. He said, throughout history, in primitive times, mankind had to hunt, mankind had to fight, and often he bled. And he bled small amounts of blood on a fairly regular basis, whether he was hunting in the brush and cutting himself with the brush or in a fight with an animal or a fight with another human being, he bled. And it was good for him. And now if a drop of blood comes out of our body, we scream and go to the doctor and get, Bactine on it. We spray ourselves. It's an interesting thought.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage.
Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Mike to Mike. Two after. So we're playing Cannonball Adderley. Is this Hippadelphia? Give me the cliff notes. See, I was thinking about apathy today, and I believe my audience has become apathetic. I believe America has become apathetic. In fact, I know America's apathetic. We're ripe for a takeover. The leadership is so corrupt and so bad that their ratings are the lowest in history. Bush is the lowest in history, or close to it, and Congress is half of his. So here's a question for you. Do you agree with me that Obama is to authentic black leadership as elevator music is to authentic jazz? Do you agree with me that McCain is to true conservatism as Bush is to coherence? Do you agree with me that the leprechaun is to authentic journalism what Daniel Steele is to real literature? Do you agree with me that Barbara Boxer is to a real senator as much as a packaged bagel is to a hot roll? Well, I guess I don't even know what I'm talking about. Play more jazz, that's all. I'll sell this on eBay. It's called Apathy Prep, my handwriting on it. Anyone want to buy it? Apathy Prep by Michael Savage. Going, going, gone. 5 cents. Do I hear five? Do I hear 6 cents? Six. I got six in the back. Six. Do I hear 7 cents? Question. Why are the great days of great jazz over? There's a political point to all this, so bear with me. Can anyone still perform like these great jazz artists? What made great jazz giants such as Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Nat Cannonball Adderley, why can't they do it anymore? Tell me why they can't do it anymore. What happened? What was it about that era that men who came up the real hard way, obviously they had to fight the evils of America, and yet they were able to come up with a horn and blow people's ears out and make people walk out saying, how did he do it? Why can't anyone do it anymore, despite all of the rhetoric about this and that and this and give me this and give me that? How come there's no Coltrane anymore, no Parker, no Adderley? Why are the jazz greats gone? Why can't anyone still perform like this? Well, I guess the answer is, why can't we get a presidential candidate worthy of the presidency? You're telling me Obama or McCain? I mean, clear the air. I don't care which side you're on. Are you telling me that Obama or McCain are up to the job of being a president? It's only because they're the only choices that you've chosen aside. You're telling me that a guy like the leprechaun is an authentic journalist? Or that Barbara Boxer is what a real senator should be like? So what do you want me to do here? I mean, I truly believe that America has entered a new phase of apathy, and it's not because the people themselves want to be apathetic. It is because the government media complex has designed apathy. They have created apathy. They've driven you into an apathetic state of mind, almost a paralysis. That is so they can continue to sell the country out lock, stock, and barrel. They can continue to roll you over a barrel by jacking your oil prices up and making you pay $5 a gallon, which is doubled in a year, without you going on a riot, without the truck drivers closing down bridges and tunnels. That is why they will let the pervs pervert the schools to distract you from what they're actually doing in Iraq. You want me to go on and on? I think it's all a conspiracy, frankly. And that leads me back, really, to ground zero here. What's left to talk about? If you're apathetic and you don't really react or care about most things on Earth, how in the world can the political system be changed? If a corrupt congressman can call the U.S. military and reinstate charges against the Marine who was exonerated, and the man is not immediately taken out in an orange jumpsuit and handcuffs by federal marshals because the president says, that's outrageous, that's not happening, I'm the commander-in-chief. So what do you want the average person to do, I ask myself? Nothing. Can't do anything about it. So you saw the polls. Confidence in Congress at record low. America shows less confidence in all of the 15 of the American institutions tracked by the so-called Gallup poll. That includes schools, organized labor, and the military. But by the way, you have to read the whole poll from the leftists at Gallup to come to understand that the military has the most high degree of confidence of the American people. You have to read pages of data to understand that people have great faith in the military and that they have very low faith in Congress. But that shows you the government media complex and how these pollsters are part of the same schemata. Only banks and the criminal justice system, that means judges, have seen as precipitous a decline as the three branches of the federal government. So you have faith in nobody or anything. Of course, they didn't ask you if you have faith in talk show hosts. Had they asked you that, it might come out that 9 out of 10 people say, I listen to talk show hosts, and I believe in them. That they wouldn't ask you at the whatever it's called, Gallup. So there it is. Play jazz for a minute. You know, when all else fails, I play Coltrane. How about giving me impressions by John Coltrane? Let him hear what great music is. Okay. I'll play it for a second or two for the person who doesn't understand this music. It's hard to explain it. It's at the same time logical and paralogical. It's at the same time rational and irrational. It's at the same time genius and madness. It's at the same time agonizingly beautiful and agonizingly painful. In other words, it was created and performed by people who lived on the edge, for those who live on the edge. And because the medical establishment has taken away your edge with Prozac, you're no longer to live on the edge. You can't take the edge. Prozac has taken you off the edge. Prozac has taken the edge out of you. America's lost its edge. That's why we're declining as a nation. We've been drugged out of existence. America is the most overdrugged nation on Earth. If I had the power, I would ban drugs for children of this nature to start with. And then I would severely restrict prescribing drugs for adults every time they have a quirk or a fear, drug them. Do you hear what I'm saying? Do you have any idea what I just said to you? Do you want me to bleed for your sins? Do you want me to take that spike and put it in my wrist every day on a cross? How many different ways do you want me to bleed to Sunday? Monday through Friday, 3 hours a day, you want me to bleed for your apathy? I'm not going to do it. You do it. This is your day. You make this show. Show me you're not apathetic. The phone number, one shot, 1-800-449-8255. Play it for 30 seconds, then I'll be right back.
Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
The stench from the bench is making me clench. 5 radical left-wing psychologically damaged lawyers on the Supreme Court said that enemy combatants being held in Guantanamo deserve the same constitutional protections as you or I do. First of all, there's a precedent which shows they're liars and they're wrong. Kennedy, who led this charge against reality and against survival, the survival of the American people, said that even in extraordinary times, we need to have constitutional protections. He's a fat-out liar. Let me explain to you where I'm getting this from. I remember the case now. It's called Ex Parte Quirin, Q-U-I-R-I-N. Look it up. 1942. It's a Supreme Court of the United States case. It upheld the jurisdiction of a U.S. military tribunal over the trial of several Operation Pastorius German saboteurs in the United States. Now, Quirin, Q-U-I-R-I-N, has been cited as a precedent for the trial by military commission of the unlawful combatants being held at Guantanamo. I will tell you what the decision said in 1942. Here it is. It said, the law of war draws a distinction between the armed forces and the peaceful populations of belligerent nations, and also between those who are lawful and unlawful combatants. Lawful combatants are subject to capture and detention as prisoners of war by opposing military forces. Unlawful combatants are likewise subject to capture and detention, but in addition, they are subject to trial and punishment by military tribunals for acts which render their belligerency unlawful. The spy who secretly and without uniform passes the military lines of a belligerent in time of war, seeking to gather military information and communicate it to the enemy, or an enemy combatant who without uniform comes secretly through the lines for the purpose of waging war by destruction of life or property, are familiar examples of belligerents who are generally deemed not to be entitled to the status of prisoners of war, but to be offenders against the law of war, subject to trial and punishment by military tribunals. Now, this is so important because today, my friends, Justice Kennedy, so-called Justice Ginsburg, Justice Souter, and a few other radical, anti-American, psychopathically crazy liberals said that detainees in Guantanamo have a right to constitutional protections. Again, I cite the case which shows they do not. Back in 1942, the eight men involved in the case were Germans. They had names. They were human beings. They had families. But they came here to kill us. They were Ernest Peter Berger, George John Dash, Herbert Hans Haupt, Heinrich Heink, Edward Keiling, Hermann Neubauer, Richard Curran, and Werner Thiel. All were born in Germany. By the way, two of them were U.S. citizens, Berger and Haupt. All were born in Germany and all had lived in the United States. Sound familiar to you? All returned to Germany between 33 and 41. After the declaration of war between the United States and the German Reich, they received training at a saboteur school near Berlin where they were instructed in the use of explosives and in methods of secret writing. Berger, Dash, Heink, and Kieran traveled from occupied France by German submarine U-202 to Amagansett Beach, Long Island, New York, landing in the hours of darkness on or about June 13th, 1942. It's almost psychologically thrilling to be telling you of this story to show you how history is repeating itself. The problem is we did not. The problem today is we have psychologically damaged individuals in black robes. In the past, we had liberals who were not psychologically damaged. They understood sanity. They understood survival. These psychopaths need to be put into a mental hospital that we have who did this to us today. That's my editorial. The remaining four Nazis board a German submarine U-584, which carried them from France to Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida. On or about June 17, 1942, they came ashore during the hours of darkness. All eight wore full or partial German uniforms to ensure treatment as prisoners of war, should they be captured on landing. So you see, they knew how to work the system then. The Long Island group was noticed by Coast Guard Beach Patrolman Frank Cullen, whom Dash attempted to bribe with $260. Cullen returned to his station and sounded the alarm. The two groups promptly disposed of uniforms and proceeded in civilian dress to New York City and Jacksonville, Florida. Shall I continue? And from there to other points in the U.S. All had received instructions in Germany from an officer of the German High Command to destroy war industries and war facilities in the United States, for which they or their relatives in Germany were to receive salary payments from the German government. It's almost chilling in how comparable it is to these Muslims being held in Guantanamo. Upon landing, Dash and Berger turned themselves into the FBI with some difficulty. since the FBI did not believe them immediately. They had to convince the FBI that they were telling the truth, and then the remaining six were taken into custody in New York and Chicago, Illinois. The FBI had no leads until Dash gave his exaggerated and romanticized version in Washington, D.C. Now here it comes. Military tribunal. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt convened a secret military tribunal on July 2, 1942, which sentenced the eight men to death. The president later commuted the death sentences of Dash and Berger to life in prison, as they had both confessed and assisted in capturing the others. Indeed, it was Dash who approached the FBI offering to turn the men in, which he then did. Berger was part of the plot to turn in the others and cooperated with the FBI extensively. Though all the men confessed and gave full statements, the remaining six were executed by electrocution on August 8, 1942. You see, we had quick justice then. We didn't have psychopaths, drug addicts, and perverts in black robes. They were electrocuted. They were fried August 8, 1942. That was within months, 1 month of the military tribunal. These Gestapo agents were fried. They didn't have little boys from Fordham and little boys that were spoiled by their mommies from NYU. And little boys with law degrees from Harvard and Berkeley going down to defend them. No, they were tried and found guilty and electrocuted. Ladies and gentlemen, let me explain to you that there is a precedent for not granting the detainees at Guantanamo the rights that you and I enjoy. I read you the decision. It was a unanimous opinion in Quirin, Q-U-I-R-I-N. There was some disagreement. Liberals may have disagreed, but the fact of the matter is it is a precedent that should have nullified the action by Kennedy, Souter, Ginsburg, and the other whacked up liberals on the Supreme Court today. Now, the president of the United States today has the power to order the immediate arrest of Justices Kennedy, Souter, Ginsburg, and the others, and put them in prison for sedition. Will George Bush do this? Never. Should George Bush do this? Definitely. The reason he will not do it is because he's afraid of the media. He is afraid of the other drug addicts in the media, the other perverts and fellow travelers in the United States of America, all of whom are seditious, and you know it. I am right. They are wrong. The survival of this nation is at stake. And we must demand that Kennedy, Souter, and Ginsburg be immediately arrested and detained by federal marshals and be put into a federal lockup before they damage this country any further. In addition to that, we must demand that all of these rats in Guantanamo be executed. This is the Savage Nation. You disagree with me? Call me at 1-800-449-8255.
Savage.
Let me just tell a 30-second dog story, because it's amazing. I said, what could I tell the people that they'd enjoy about the dog? Well, it's just that. I come home. It's the same every night. He gets so crazy. And, you know, dogs are beautiful. I've always had dogs who get excited when they're young. But this one is different. He runs. And you ever see a rabbit run down a pasture? How every number of steps he leaps like with a hop? That's what Teddy does. He has a hop in him. I don't know where the hop came from. He's more rabbit than dog in a way. He runs and then throws himself up with a little hop and tugs at my clothing like in a comic book. And in the beginning, I'd say, Teddy, stop. You're going to rip my clothing. You know what I've come to? I say, Teddy, go ahead, rip my clothing. I don't even care. I let my arms hang down. He can rip my pants. He can rip my – yeah, he doesn't mean to rip it. He's just trying to say hello. And he keeps going and going and going till he starts to wheeze. I have to stop him, and I have to grab him. I'm afraid the dog's going to, like, stroke out from excitement. But you know what? Why I don't stop him anymore, I'll tell you why. Because I know one day, unless I die from global warming or from a terrorism attack, one day he'll be old, and one day he won't be able to run, and he won't be motivated to run anymore, like my other dog, Snowy. She could hardly move. They become old like we do. They get arthritis, and they become, oh, you're home again? I had a rotten day. Don't even bother me. Look, I'm in the room. That's what they become later on. So I said, if this is what he is now, then enjoy it. Enjoy his joy, because In what, 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, whatever it may be, assuming that the earth doesn't melt down because of Al Gore's hot air, the dog won't be able to do it. And what?
Warning. The
The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000. You'll notice that you can contribute to the Legal Defense Fund under a new address. The mail goes to the Michael Savage. That's if a check, a money order, cash. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. And God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech.
Savage.
Everyone in the government is telling me to expect a nuclear attack, a biological attack, not when, but definitely you're going to get it. And in a deadpan voice, no emotion, nothing, emotionless, like bureaucrats. I never saw anything like this. And the idiot journalists who are supposed to represent us sit there like dunces. And on the Cuba question, Mr. Cheney, right on to the next question. Just an issue today. Just a question. Honey, look, I got a big meeting after this. You got that town car ready? Yeah, and tomorrow, do we have booked that pimp that I saw on the Larry King last week? Yeah, get me the pimp. And on Tuesday, I want the hooker. We have the vice president here today. Who do we have on Wednesday? Do we have the paraplegic hooker with the mustache? Okay, I'll be – this is the media we have today. What am I, the last man in the world with a brain? Am I the only man left in the media with a brain and the guts to say what needs to be said? I tell you the truth, I am really worried. You think this is all theatrics. You liberals think it's a damn joke, don't you? It is not a joke anymore. You've killed America. You've made the government incompetent. It can't function. They know, hey, look, they're no dummies. They didn't get to the top of the pinnacle where they are by being stupid. They know who the enemy is. They know where they are, but they're afraid to touch him. Because you'll be the first to scream like the rats and mice that you are. Racial profiling. So what do you want me to do? I know where it's at. We no longer have the best and brightest. Sometimes I say we don't have the best and brightest anymore. We have the worst and whitest in power. It's no longer the best and the brightest. It's the worst and the whitest. You want me to tell you how to solve this problem? I'll lay it out for you, Jack. I've said it before, but you're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you. You're not going to believe what Michael said, what's going to come out of my lips now. No one's going to believe what I'm going to tell you. But I've said it before. It went over the airwaves. It went out like a bullet. Nobody heard it. We have fraternity boys running the country. We have elite fraternity boys who have never faced the real world. They have been protected like princes from childhood right to where they are today. I go into the worst gangs in America. I would get the baddest blacks, the baddest whites, the baddest Hispanics, the baddest Asians, and I bring them into a cabinet. And I say, look, boys, here's what we're doing. We're at war. What would you do to solve this problem? I can guarantee you that they could solve that problem much faster than the frat boys. That's what I say. What do you say? What do you say? It's not, you haven't heard this anywhere before? Doesn't make sense? Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. It's been done before. It was done in World War II. You see, the government of elitists at the time knew there was a problem on the waterfronts of America. They knew that the Germans had their Gestapo spies all over the waterfronts of the East Coast and the West Coast. And they knew who controlled the waterfront. And they didn't hire a smart idiot from Harvard or Yale. They went to Lucky Luciano, and they cut a deal with the mafia. And the mafia made sure that the Gestapo didn't function on the waterfront because they wound up with a meat hook in their back and it was swimming with the fishes. And that was the end of the Gestapo on the waterfront, 99%. So it has been done before. I didn't invent this. It's got to be done now or we're cooked. Stop with the frat boy talk. Stop with the frat boy solutions. Stop with the academic ease. These people are frightening me. What would you say would be the solution? I'll tell you what, I gave you one solution. I gave you brass tacks. took a big risk, brass tacks. Solution one, go to the baddest Americans, bring them into the seats of power, and ask them what they would do. Don't even tell the people you did it. That's all. Maybe they've done it already for all I know. If I could figure it out, maybe they could figure it out. Ask them how they'd solve the problem. After all, they have businesses too. What do you think? They want to live in a world that's destroyed by the Taliban mentality? There'd be no crime. They wouldn't be able to make a buck. So believe me, they're the best capitalists you could ever imagine. That's right. Gangsters are very good capitalists. They love a capitalist system. They hate socialism. They hate terrorism. It's bad for business. Go to them. End the story. And if they're listening to me, you know I'm right. So you know that I'm right, but I'm not running garbage. I'm one guy on the radio, man, all alone, just twisting in the wind here. No, nothing. No dinners, no phone calls, no emails. You know what I'm saying? I come from another world. They don't want to know me. I don't want to know them. But the fact of the matter is, even an average man can figure this one out. You don't have to be a talk show host to figure it out. I figured it out. Step two, we got Polaris submarines or whatever they're calling them now. For 50 years, we've invested trillions of dollars. You got them floating around under the ice cap, over the Arctic. And here they are popping in the ice. They could do anything. Beep, beep, beep. Yeah, Red October, Hunt for October. Well, Russia's gone. They're loaded to the rafters with nuclear missiles. You tell the snakehead, and you know who they are. We all know who they are. So much as the hair of one American child gets singed. And if you think that's a little harsh, think to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Because much better men did the same thing. They said, you know what? It's us versus them. They declared war on us. We don't want to sacrifice 500,000 or a million more American boys. Screw them. Here comes the bomb. Here comes the judge. And that was the end of World War II. Bay Area, Uri, you're on the Savage Nation.
Let me say that I am old enough to have known the very thing you're talking about. We beat the most evil axis that ever existed. Nazi Germany, dictator Italy, and Imperial Japan and all their satellites. So I would make a model that copied what they did. First of all, even then, in those days, we had an Office of Civil Defense. We had the captains on the block that told us when, how, and why. We were issued sandboxes. We were told that they would tell our schools how to evacuate. We had some sense, not of foreboding, but some sense of what would be if necessary. We infiltrated their spy networks. We supported their partisan efforts. We broke their codes and created some of our own. And then the bottom line, if you take that to modern day thinking, and that's what I say, follow the mode. We know for sure, at least unless our government's lying, there are 63 nations harboring Al-Qaeda. Those are the nations I would first target to let them know the following. If Al-Qaeda is there and you don't get rid of them, we declare you persona non grata and you're out of our country. In the meantime, recruit from malcontents of the Arab-speaking world, and there are many of them, where we trained every one of their pilots.
I would go on a little faster track. I'd let it be known to terrorist leaders that if they don't stop this in our country before it starts, we're going to nuke their capitals. We're going to knock them off the planet. I can guarantee you they can stop it faster than we can.
One thing, on the bottom of my little list, I have punish all offenders severely with heavy sentences if the crime denotes it. However, identify.
Wait. What do you mean offenders? What kind of offenders?
Let me tell you what. I would suggest that every alien in this country has to register, particularly the enemy aliens, which we've outlined as being enemies, and given a certain time frame. If they don't report, then they're deported, or if they do any harm.
But Uri, that's all well and good. How about the enemy aliens who have snuck into the country who have no identity or false identities? That's not going to help. You're giving them the initiative. We've got to take the initiative. We've got to go and hunt them down for the government. The government won't do it. They're afraid of being called racist because the liberals have them in a bind. Thanks for the call. It's all about liberalism destroying America. I'm sorry. It all comes back. The federal government is paralyzed right now. It cannot become proactive. And that's why they're talking around. If you heard the speech last week, it said, we want you to be vigilant, we want you to be knowledgeable, but we want you to remain an American. Now, what does that code word mean? Don't you dare ever say anything against an ethnic group. Watch out. You say anything about a person of color, and the FBI will get you. Oh, that they can do. That they'll be at your door. Knock, knock, who's there? Oh, you said something about persons of color. Come with us. Take an overnight bag. But wait a minute. I was just following with... Never mind. You committed a race crime. You said something about a person to cover. Come with us. But what about taking the person with cover? No, they haven't committed a crime, but you have. We got laws on the books and we're following them. This way, This way, we got a camp for you. Put in the word but. There was your best hour you're going to get all week. The rest is addendum.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Since one of my callings is being a storyteller, people say, you know, Savage, you're a great talk show host because you're a storyteller. Yeah, but the stories are based on reality and truth. They're not fiction. So here's what I wanted to say. Remember I told you the story earlier about the guy, the rabbi who flies all the way to Belgium and doesn't know the meaning of the trip? Then guess what you do? Met the guy at the airport. The guy was going to commit suicide. And then because of me, he said he wouldn't. And then the rabbi says, you can go home now. That was the reason for coming here. The point is that you don't even know what your reason on earth is. You may not know it until you go on to heaven. And then you look back. As William Blake wrote, life must be lived forward, but it can only be understood backwards. You don't know what your life's meaning is. So you have to lead a decent life. And you don't know what the meaning of it is until it's like over, maybe. And then you get to that the pearly gates. But there's another meaning to that story to me, and that is this. Remember the paratrooper called me, and he doesn't know the reason God spared his life when his chute didn't open? The point is that you don't have to take home an Oscar to validate your life. The point is you don't have to be the most skinniest, most beautiful girl in town to be a valid woman. Your validation can come from simple things, and I have to repeat it, no matter how much of a homily this may sound like or that you've heard it before. Your validation can come from your child, from baking that child cookies and being home for that child. Your validation can come from helping somebody. Your validation can come from 1,000 things. And the point is you don't have to win an Oscar to be a great person. That's the point of the story.
Savage.
Albany, New York. James, you're up on the Savage Nation.
My point is I grew up in New York in a Democratic family. Christian family, and I've always voted Democrat, but ever since 9/11, I paid more attention. Especially, I really enjoy your program because I think you tell it exactly how it should be. You tell it how it is. You don't bite your tongue on anything. So I really appreciate that. And I just see the Democratic Party just playing to a lot of special interests. They haven't said one thing to, as far as I'm concerned, about what they're going to do to fix the problems that they think are going on in America. All they have done to me is preach hate. So,
wow. James, you're a man who sees right through all of the crap. James, you're a very, very, very intelligent man. And I've said before, it's every man that's going to save this country, not Superman. See, this is the beautiful part of America. The elites, if you want to call them that, it's one way to put it. But I don't use that word because I don't think they're elite. I wouldn't put them in that category. They're not in the arista, the left. I wouldn't put them as the geniuses, you know, who are better than everybody. They're not elites to me. They're just the other side is how I see it. But they always underestimate men like that last caller. They say, oh, he's a truck driver. He's not educated. He's one of them. Well, the fact of the matter is most of us are one of them. There's a guy who wrote a book called The Two Americas, and he's a flaming lefty. He advised Clinton, Gore, Blair, Mandela, and Gerhard Schroeder. Schroeder's a socialist. Mandela is an outright socialist communist. Tony Blair is a socialist. Al Gore is a socialist. So it's a book from the socialist side, which they call liberalism today. And he says there's a cultural split in America, and we know that. We didn't need him to say it. But here's what he said. Within that divide, the major parties represent two cultural blocks clustered around deep splits about faith, family, and moral values. On the Republican side, there are, he says, Christian evangelicals, privileged men, blue-collar men without a college education, exurbia and rural voters. On the Democratic side, you have black power and, to a lesser degree, Latinos, super-educated women, secular warriors, people who don't go to church and don't own guns, the unions, and more generally, the cosmopolitan states. And he includes everyone in California and most of the Northeast, with high concentrations of college-educated voters environmentalists and minorities. Well, the funny thing is I don't fall into either of those categories. I'm an independent. I am not a registered Republican. Now, other than that, nothing in there makes sense to me. I'm sort of a blue-collar man with a PhD. So how do I fit into that category? I'm not a Christian evangelical. I'm not a privileged man. I'm the son of an immigrant. I worked for everything I have. Nobody gave me anything. In fact, they try to stop me from having everything I have. They try to steal it from me, but no one's been able to do it yet. I don't fit any of those categories, and that's why I'm not so sure that I'm the only one in this deep cultural divide who seems to be amongst the blue-collar guys without a college education who owns a gun. I own guns. I've always loved guns. Going back to Jamaica High School in Queens, New York, there was a rifle club. Did you know that in New York City when I was a kid, there was a rifle club in the basement of Jamaica High School? To this day, I can remember the smell of the Mossberg 22 caliber match rifles that we used. And I used to love a break from geometry to go down and shoot some gunpowder off and smell the gunpowder. It was quite a change. And incidentally, nobody ever picked up a gun and ran through the halls and killed anybody. Nobody turned and put the gun in their mouth and shot their brains out. There was no Ritalin then. There was no Prozac then. There were no drugs to make people totally insane then. And there were some very good World War II vets who were our mentors and our teachers in those gun clubs, I remember very, very well. So I don't fit any of these categories. And I don't think that it's as clear as this jerk thinks it is. I think that's just a convenient way to group everybody and to make the other side look stupid.
Savage.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000. You'll notice that you can contribute to the Legal Defense Fund under a new address. The mail goes to the Michael Savage. That's of a check, a money order, cash. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. And God bless you for helping protect freedom of speech.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage.
Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
If you go into the Old Testament, if you want to call it the Old Testament, if you want to call it the Holy Scriptures, depending upon your orientation, either way, okay, the original book of monotheism, if is what I'd like to call it. That's because Christianity and Islam followed this word of God in the Jewish religion. That is the Torah, the five books of Moses, which is what this is. And it's the word of God as revealed to Israel through a lawgiver, a prophet, and sage. So that's what the Torah is. It's the five books of Moses. Then you had a new version called Christianity, a different version. And then you had Islam followed that. Most of you don't even know the history of the development of religion, but I think you should know that. They're all based upon this book. But if you look at the book, you see murder all over the place. Are you then going to say that all people who are following the Old Testament are murderers? Or should you say that Judaism is a violent religion? It isn't. No one practices religion, a religion which says you kill somebody for lying down with a beast. You look in Exodus, and you take a look at all of the things in Exodus that are punishable by death. I'll read them to you. Thou shalt not suffer a sorceress to live. That would mean half the talking heads on television would have to be killed. Whosoever lieth with a beast shall surely be put to death. That would take care of half the politicians in San Francisco. He that sacrificeth unto the God, save unto the Lord only, shall be utterly destroyed. You know, I mean, you read this stuff. He that smiteth his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He that curseth his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. I'd be dead already. He that curseth his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. I would have been dead 1,000 times in my life because things come out of your mouth. You don't mean them. Half the time I say things in anger. You think I mean them? God knows I don't mean them. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, my chest. And if men strive together and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart and yet no harm follow, he shall be surely fined. See, that's fair. According as the woman's husband shall lay upon him. In other words, if you hurt a woman and she loses the child, the husband says, okay, Johnson, we lost the baby. You owe us this. That's it. And he shall pay as the judge is determined. But listen to this. But if any harm follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. I may actually go into religion. I find it more interesting than talk radio. See, if I ever had a church, the first Savage Church, I mean, we would really rock and roll. First of all, the singing I'd have to have, and there would be black gospel singers. It'd be the only chorus I would permit in. Because I used to go into black churches as a kid in New York. I'd sneak in. The place was literally moving. They weren't moving. The church was moving. The singers were standing still. I mean, they really felt the Lord. I want to tell you something. You want to know people who felt Jesus. It was and probably still is. Folks like that. I've been in many religious institutions. I've been in the Al-Aqsa Mosque upon the Temple Mount. I've been inside of it. Have you? I've been upon the wall, the holy wall, of which is really the remnant of the ancient temple. I've been in some of the greatest cathedrals on earth. I have felt God's presence in them. Now, of course, you could feel God's presence in a forest, or in a star, or in a flower, or in a puppy's nose. I understand that, particularly in a baby's eye, or in a baby's cry. I know that as well. So you don't have to go into a great temple to see God. But the point I am making is that God exists. Now you look at the book that gave birth to this knowledge or this understanding, and you find violence, you find death, you find hellfire, you find brimstone. And so what should you say? Well, who practices it is the issue. And what is it? Why should it even be in there? Shouldn't it be revised and be taken out of there? Well, no, it's a document. But I don't know any Jews who are Orthodox who go out and smite sorceresses. I certainly don't know any Jewish people who smash planes into the World Trade Center to kill infidels, because they don't misinterpret an ancient biblical tractate. They are modern people. If you take a man as he is, you make him better. If you take a man as he is, you make him worse. If you take a man as he can be, you make him better, more or less. You want to find the Goethe quote for me, David. Look it up, G-O-E-T-H-E. The sufferings of young Werther. He did not invent the Mercedes-Benz. No, Goethe did not invent the Mercedes-Benz. He did not invent the Porsche. He did not invent the Volkswagen. He did not invent the Tiger tank. A man also, or a woman that divineth by a ghost or a familiar spirit, shall surely be put to death. That would be half the children at Boston University today, with black lipstick and goth costumes. They all think they're divine. They're vining. They think that they're Satan worshippers. They think they're cool. Usually they're ugly dogs. You ever see the people who are into this stuff? They can't meet a guy, so they become gay. Then they can't even meet a girl, so they become a goth. Then they become a goth, they can't even find somebody to torture them. They don't know what to do anymore. You know what I'm saying? They go down the road. They can't meet a guy, so they become gay. They become gay, then they can't meet a girl. Then they become a goth. They can't even find anyone to torture them. It's so true. You look at these people. They think there's like, ooh, it's like Halloween to most of them. Look, I live in San Francisco. I see these mutts walking around with the costumes on and the black lipstick and the eyeshadow. They think they're scaring an average guy. I look at them. I feel revulsed by it. And I feel bad for them, to be honest with you. I've no anger towards them. They're dogs through and through. They're dogs. No one wants them. So anyway, what would you do if you were them? You'd look for someone to lasso you and do anything. Please hurt me. There, you got to pity them. You know, you have to have. You didn't know that came from the Bible, most of you, an eye for an eye. A lot of everybody knows that, but you don't know where it came from. You probably thought it came from Eminem, the ignorance level. Or if I say a still small voice, you say, oh, yeah, wasn't that written by Winona Ryder when she was shoplifting? A still small voice told me to cut off the tags. No, it actually came from 1 Kings. It's all in the Bible. Plowshares, a big liberal organization. Isaiah. and they shall beat their swords into plowshares. Yeah, that's all well and good. I'm not beating my Glock into a plowshare. I'm not taking my AR-15 and beating it into a fork. I'd rather turn a plowshare right now into an AR-15 if I could, despite what the morons in the Ninth Circuit Court of Schlemiel's wrote the other day. No gun calls. Wolf and Lamb, Babylon. I have so many Post-its in my Bible. That's amazing. You know, this book I should sell on eBay, but I wouldn't sell it for $1 million. No, this is a treasure. You realize that the Savage Holy Scriptures with my Post-its in it could probably on auction bring a fortune on people who gamble on the future fame of people. I don't want to sell it for $1 million. Why? Because it's my guidebook to my mind, my fears, my hopes, and my beliefs. And I brought you into a land of fruitful fields to eat the fruit thereof and the good thereof. But when you entered, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. I read that sometimes, and I say to myself, Savage, you were brought into a land of fruitful fields called America. Your grandfather killed himself to get here, and they died young so that you could live in a land of fruitful fields to eat the fruit thereof. No one said you shall have it for free. No one said you should not have to reach up and pick that fruit. No one said you shouldn't have to work to get the fruit. So be careful, Savage, that you don't defile the land that God gave you to make your heritage an abomination. I want to leave the world a better place. You see?
Savage.
Harry, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Okay, Michael. Love listening to your show. I happen to disagree with most of what you say. Let me ask you a question, a hypothetical. Red China attacks our country and lands here and is fighting. Then do we as Americans become patriots or terrorists or insurgents? What are we if we're defending our country?
Well, you see, it's interesting to start thinking like that, but it shows how far you have gone as an American citizen that you can't even back your own country in a war. Of course, if they landed here, we would fight them and we would be patriots. But that is not ipso facto, therefore the Iraqis are patriots. That's number one. Because you are an American, Harry. You should be backing our troops and not asking yourself such a silly question. That would be like saying, when the Americans were bombing Germany in World War II to take out Hitler and the Nazis, weren't the SS officers patriots? Would you argue that, Harry?
Well, to a certain degree, yes and no. They were not patriots because that was a whole different scenario.
Wait. What do you mean? You're trying to argue that the Iraqi rebels are patriots because they're defending their homeland. So would you then argue that Hitler's soldiers, not the Wehrmacht who were enlisted, I am talking about the SS, the Death's Head Brigade, the Adolf Hitler Brigade, wouldn't they be considered super patriots by your definition, Harry?
No, they were not patriots. I do not consider them super patriots.
Why not? Why wouldn't you? Then you're double talking me.
No, I'm trying to show you two.
How is it that you can say that Hitler's SS officers were not patriotic, but you can suddenly say that the Iraqi bums are patriots? Where's your thinking coming from?
I'm saying that the Iraqi people, the Sunnis and Shiites who are from Iraq, they are the people who are fighting for their country. I believe that there are terrorists.
Wait a minute, sir. But by the same logic that you're using, if you want to call it internationalist logic, wouldn't then the SS officers also have been patriots?
No, I don't believe that. I think it's a total.
Well, wait, hold it. Tell me why you don't believe that.
Okay, because the SS and the stormtroopers, that whole regime was literally out to take over the world. They were trying to occupy other countries. So therefore, since they were
wait, hold on a minute. But radical Islam wants to export Islam to the whole world. Ask the preacher in Fallujah, in Najaf, that radical fat slob. He wants to see the whole world Islamicized. So by the same token, he wants to take over the world.
So Islam is our enemy. I agree with that. I'm saying I don't disagree with everything you say, but I agree with that. I agree that Islam is our enemy. But the point.
Well, hold it. I don't say Islam is our enemy. I said radical Islam is our enemy. That's quite a different thing. So don't put words in my mouth. But, Harry, if you're trying to take that internationalist look at the thing from the other guy's point of view approach, why then you could never fight in an American war? Because you'd say the other guy is just defending his homeland, too. Harry, it would be like saying you're a fighter, you're a boxer. Let's say you're a middleweight, and you're getting in the ring with the other guy, and both of you pray to God to win. Would you then say, well, the other guy is just defending his honor, he wants to win, too? Would you take his side or would you take your side?
Well, of course, I'm going to always take my side. But
why don't you take the side of the U.S. Marines then instead of telling me that the other guys are patriots?
take the side of our troops. I support our troops 1,000,000%. I'm totally.
But how could you support our troops 1,000,000% if you're arguing that the Iraqis who are killing them are just patriots defending their homeland?
I'm giving you a hypothetical. I'm not saying that all Iraqis are patriots. There are a lot of them that are not. But a great majority of them are, and they're just trying to defend their country.
Nonsense. The patriots want their country to be democratized, and they don't want women in burqas, and they don't want Islam forced down people's throats, and they don't want to burn Jews, and they don't want to kill Christians. Those are the real patriots. These are vermin. These are internationalist terrorists. They're vermin. That's why we're killing them.
Not the Iraqi people. I'm sorry, Michael. I respect...
I didn't say the Iraqi people. I said the Iraqi people want democracy or relative democracy. But the bums we're fighting in Fallujah and Najaf are not the Iraqi people. They are fanatics who want to export their religion and dominate the world, and B, they are surrounded by foreigners who aren't even Iraqis, Harry.
Those are the ones who are our major enemy. I agree with you there. I do.
Oh, so what are we arguing about?
We're arguing about that. I think that we are categorizing and generalizing that a lot of these Iraqi citizens who are, and I really believe, I may be wrong, Michael, but I really believe that they are trying to defend their country from an occupying force. Yes, many of them want us there because without us there, it would be bloody civil.
Well, I don't buy that. I don't buy that. We liberated them from a monster, the Hitler or Stalin of their world, and now they're shooting us in the back. Let them go to hell. We liberated them. Now we expect something from them. With freedom comes responsibility. It's not a one-way ticket. Now they've got to perform for us. They've got to join the family of man. They can't go back to their psychotic ways.
Michael, like I said, I respectfully agree to disagree. I respect your opinion. I love your show. And you know what?
You know why, Harry? Because a good part of you actually agrees with me, even though you're probably a lifetime Democrat. I don't intend to change you. I'm not here to front for George Bush. But you got to understand what I'm saying, Harry. The majority of Iraqis want the radicals out of their country. They don't want to live in Afghanistan under the Taliban. They want the freedoms that we have here. And in order for them to enjoy it, they're going to have to play ball with us. They're going to have to do it our way. We're not going to have to do it their way.
I agree. But again, I just hate generalizing, saying that all the Iraqis are insurgents and that they're terrorists. They're not. They're really not.
But what we're saying the same thing. I just said most of them want these bums out of there. Most Iraqis do not want this fat cleric screaming holy war. Most Iraqis want the Pakistanis and the Iranians and the Saudi terrorists who have come in to help that Sadr out of there. So we're saying the same thing in different ways, Harry.
Well, okay, maybe we are. Maybe we're looking at it from two different points of view.
There it is. You see, that's the problem, is we're 3,000 miles away, Harry. If we were over a cup of coffee, we'd probably realize we agree more than we disagree.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Gary in Washington, D.C., glad to hear from you. What's on your mind?
I'd like to respectfully disagree about your racial profiling. The reason why is because, the bombings in Oklahoma City wouldn't have met your racial profiling.
Oh, Gary, please stop bringing up old history. We all heard that false lie put out by the Muslim pressure groups about Timothy McVeigh. He's long dead and buried already. Live in the present, Gary. We know who our enemy is today. They all come from the same region. They all practice the same religion. So stop the big hogwash about dangerous Christians. It doesn't sell anymore, Gary. We want to live. We don't want to die. So that one doesn't fly.
Okay, I'll give you another one that doesn't fly then. The people that were probably behind the development and the dropping of the atomic bomb, the only time that it's ever been used in our history against innocent people, were probably also white people. So your racial profile...
Oh, sir, wait, sir, what does that have to do with today? I'm not following you. Why do you suppose the atomic bombs were dropped, Gary?
I feel that you are...
Gary, hold it, Gary. Tell me why the atomic bombs were dropped under the orders of President Truman.
Well, whether they were dropped or not, we are the only nation.
What do you mean, whether they were dropped or not? They were dropped, not or not. Why did President Truman order the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Tell me why. Is it because he was a white cracker from Kansas and wanted to kill Japanese, Gary? Is that what you're implying?
That way about soldiers that are burned to a...
Gary, it is a talk program. Are you implying that President Truman was a white cracker racist who wanted to kill Japanese?
I'm not saying that. He is... I'm not saying that because I don't deal with those terms.
Wait, you don't deal with those terms? You certainly do. Don't act high and mighty with me. 2 seconds ago, you just said that Timothy McVeigh and white people blew up Oklahoma City, so we shouldn't focus on people from the Middle East with regard to terrorism. I mean, you do deal in those terms. That's all we're talking about are those terms.
Continue the violence and the hate that we have. You are a hate monger. You are not.
Oh, I see, but Gary, you're late in coming. I've heard this before. Actually, no, I'm a survivor, Gary. You're a sheeple. You're the type of person who'd rather go over the cliff with your political correctness than survive. I can tell by your call that you're a member in good standing of the ACLU.
This is a human dignity and nobility. That's what I believe.
What are you lecturing me on now? Where did nobility come from? What's more noble than survival?
Survival not through violence. Survival not through hurting somebody else, but helping.
Oh, so you were taught not to hit back. Is that it, Gary? You were taught that when a man comes to rape your wife, you reason with him? When a man comes to blow up your house, you say to him, why are you doing it? Can we talk about it? Is that what you were taught, Gary? Thank God that you're not defending this country, or we'd all be on a prayer rug praying to Mecca, and most of us would have our throats cut and we'd be charred corpses. What's wrong with you, sir? If you were prevailing in 1940, we'd be speaking German or we'd be lampshades. You're telling me that there was no excuse for violence against the Nazis?
I'm not talking about Germany. I'm talking about you.
Oh, wait a minute, sir. You just brought up past history. You brought up the dropping of atomic bombs. You've opened the door on a historical perspective. You certainly are talking about Germany. Because you refuse to answer it because you know the correct answer is, of course we had to fight the Nazis to survive, or you would have been a lampshade. You know that, Gary.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.